All right, and we are back with another episode of the Pocket Protectors Podcast. My name is Jason Brown, joined as always by the full crew, the gang. Doctor, reporting live from, I think, the garage today. How you doing, my man?
The unfinished basement. Yeah, I mean, this is fun. It's always nice to chat football. I know we're 2 weeks into the abyss. I'm excited for what's to come in the off season.
All right. And then our man Luke reporting from the best coast.
Oh yeah.
Why aren't you at the All-Star game right now, Luke?
I just can't like get really into the NBA. Like I can follow it and I find the personalities hilarious and fun, but I don't know. Basketball just doesn't do it for me.
And then the NBA, another thing. So when I lived in Atlanta, you know, we hosted, you know, the All-Star weekend a couple times, and there's no better way to make yourself really feel poor than when All-Star weekend comes to your city. Cause like all the places that you used to be able to get into, you show up and they're asking for covers that are just astronomical, and you just basically have to go home and drink beer with your friends because you can't go anywhere. But I digress. Guys, it's the first time we've talked. I know we've been slacking a little bit. We've had some sick kids and some other things going on, but it's our first time getting together since the Super Bowl here. And the Super Bowl was kind of viewed by many as maybe a jumping off point, a starting point for, you know, a revolution in football when, you know, nerds all around. I was following on Twitter during the game, and everyone was rejoicing as Doug Peterson was actually playing the numbers correctly, being aggressive, going for it on fourth down, scoring touchdowns instead of kicking field goals. And so, I need to get your takes. What are your thoughts? How happy were you to hear that Doug Peterson admitted, an NFL football guy admitted that he had, you know, someone in his ear spitting game theory to him throughout the game to help him understand, you know, what he should be doing to maximize his team's chances of winning. And do you guys think this is something that's going to catch on across the league and other teams are going to really start to invest, not just in using, you know, analytics and, you know, the draft and player acquisitions and things like that, but really helping to optimize, you know, in-game decisions and maximizing their performance there. So Eric, I know we've talked about this a couple of times, but I guess what were your thoughts watching the game, seeing all those things? I mean, the game itself was phenomenal. Super Bowl. What were your thoughts in general?
I think so. We were on a lot of New England games this year for the PFF picks. I don't think we ever picked against them, to be honest, against the spread. And like, I think like the thing about the Patriots that was always comforting is that you always knew that the Patriots were never going to give up cheap yards. You know, if it's fourth down and one at the opponent's 29, they're going to go for it and they're going to get that 7 points. You know what I'm saying? Or, you know, they're going to give themselves the best chance to do it. If they're kicking off, like they're going to kick it short and cover and have the other team start at the 21, all those kinds of things. And for the first time all season, I watched the New England Patriots game and I saw the other team unwilling to dump points, expected points, to dump, you know, field position, all these kinds of things to the Patriots. And what it really did was it was like this beautiful, pure football game where it was just talent against talent. And I think that was like, you know, the best thing. Analytics, like people are always afraid of analytics, right? They're afraid because, you know, it might cause them to have to learn something new. It might cause them to, you know, it might diminish their role and sort of like, and I got in trouble for saying this, but it diminishes their role possibly in the marketplace of ideas, all this kind of stuff. But I think what analytics does, I think, is it drills down deeper. And now we get to see like the Philadelphia third string running back and how good he is against the New England linebacker. We get to see, we get to see like, you know, fourth down and one from the New England one, we get to see a play run on that instead of a field goal. And then like always coming back later and wondering what would happen if they had those 4 points back, all those kinds of things. I think that was like the real gift of the Super Bowl, in my opinion.
I feel
and
like
Luke, man, what about you, man? Really, when you were watching it, what were your thoughts on everything?
I mean, I was having a blast watching it just because it was like a really fun football game. But I feel like after having some time to stew in it, it feels like teams are going to learn the wrong lesson and just like force their quarterbacks to run a bunch of RPOs. Like even if their quarterback quarterback is good and doesn't need such easy reads. Like, they're just going to do it because that's what they think works.
Ooh.
Like, I don't have a lot of trust in NFL franchises to, like, learn the proper lessons and adapt to new strategies. Like, it took offenses, like, 6 years to adopt, like, passing the ball. Like, they're not going to learn immediately off of one Super Bowl. But it was really fun to watch two teams that do embrace the ideas behind analytics, or at least just using analytics to, like, make the right choices. It was fun to watch two teams actually make the right choices instead of, like, Mike Mularkey punting from his own 40 down three touchdowns in a playoff game.
Okay, we've done that a couple times as well. And as an avid listener of the Pro Football Focused Forecast, there's just one counterpoint that I want to start on before I let Eric finish it, because he knows it way better than I do. But I think that one of the things that happened is that RPO lesson, which it may still be taken away that way, because, you know, all the teams don't yet subscribe to Pro Football Focus. Not yet, anyway. Soon, but not yet. So there may be a couple teams that get the wrong idea based on the commentary during the game. But Eric, how many actual RPOs were run in that game? Because it seemed like every play was an RPO based on the commentary, but I heard something different when I was listening to you and George.
Yeah, and not to dig on Al Michaels, but, like, the issue was there were two passes that the Philadelphia Eagles threw that were on RPOs, and both of them were, like, bubble screens to Nelson Agholor that generated 12 yards of offense. The issue is, and, like, I always wonder too, like, you know, is this just play action from the shotgun, or is this, like, actual RPO? And so it is hard to discern those things, but literally, if you just look at, like, the left tackle, if he's stepping backwards, it's just play action. If he's driving down in the run, you know, to run block, he's, you know, this is some inside football here, guys, from a mathematician. But if a guy's like blocking down as a run blocker, it's an RPO. And they're literally, now granted, there were, like, something like 7 to 9 run plays that the Eagles ran that were RPOs, like where you look at the receivers and the running pass patterns. And one of the long runs, I think it was like a 36-yard run by Jay Ajayi. One of those runs did come on one of those plays. So, but you're still talking, I mean, if you wanted to listen to people, they were saying, like, RPOs are being run on, like, every freaking play. And in reality, it was, like, probably like 10 plays out of, you know, 70 to 80 that the Eagles were running. So it wasn't really that big of a deal. Most of the time, it's simply just play action out of the shotgun, which is different, right? Like, most of the time, we don't see that necessarily as much. But it's not going to move the linebackers around at all like an RPO would.
And Eric, one of the other things that, you know, that obviously came out of this game was that, you know, there were some people that maybe were a little bit more smug than they needed to be about it, you know, in the Twitter community. You know, imagine that, kind of talking about the fact that, you know, it shows how far we still have to come when, you know, Doug Peterson just making decisions that were really mathematically sound decisions were considered super brave, and like he was some avant-garde guy and all these things, when really what he was doing was just making decisions that, you know, maximize his team's expected points and gave his team the best chance to win. And I was wondering, I know that you guys have kind of talked about it a little bit. I was wondering if you could get into that for us just a little bit and just kind of help us understand that, you know, the edge that teams can get by making decisions like the ones Doug Peterson did to help his team, you know, win the Super Bowl.
Yeah. So fourth down and one from your opponent's 1 yard line is about 4.5 expected points. So basically you could do the math, you figure it out. It's like, you know, you basically convert on that at somewhere between, you know, 55% and 65%. And so, like, you divide 7 by that or whatever, and you get 4.5. And obviously kicking a field goal is basically a gimme from there. So, you know, you basically, by making that decision, are making a plus 1.5 point decision. And over the course of an entire football game, obviously, like, those points add up. And so, as you said, like, we're all talking about these folks like they're these brave, you know, these brave souls, but in reality it's just a, you know, positive expected points play. I think probably the more ballsy play but still mathematically sound was near the end of the game, when the Eagles are driving down one. They went for it from their own 45, and that play had something like a third or to a half of a point difference in expected points between going for it on fourth and one there and punting it to New England. Clearly, punting it to New England puts them in a poor position. But going for it, converting a fourth and one is a relatively, 60% or something like that proposition. And so it's a positive expected points play. And so even there, like, they make the, like, what we would consider as math people, the safe play, right? It's the higher percentage play, but almost everybody in football says it's risky. You know, whereas we think, right, punting the New England Patriots, giving them a chance with the ball is risky, right? So, it was pretty interesting to see them sort of embrace what we would consider like rudimentary ideas. And like I said, it was like the winners of the Super Bowl were people like us watching the game and being like, thank God you made the right choice. Thank God you make the right choice, sort of over and over and over again.
And not even just like, thank God that you made the right choice. Like, thank God that you made the right choice and it works. Because I remember, can't remember if it was you or Luke, very early in us kind of getting together to do these podcasts, really thinking about probabilities, the kind of the general public understanding probabilities may be a little bit different than, you know, folks that are in kind of the math community and thinking of it like you either you hit or you don't hit. And so it was like people making the right decisions, but they worked. So, you know, they weren't slaughtered for it. If they made those same right decisions and the probability went the other way, then, you know, we probably never see anyone go for it on fourth down again for like the next 25 years or something like
that. Was the Belichick going for it on fourth down and one from his own like 20 against Indianapolis in 2009? And like that was a positive expected points play, but it just didn't work out. And then they lost and like he was, you know, slaughtered for it. But, you know, it over time, like those smart decisions pay off generally.
It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy because I feel like people, like coaches, will do the thing that preserves themselves more than they'll do the thing that like actually wins them games in those situations. Like if you go for it, it gives you a better chance to win the game, but going for it and not getting it will like get you a lot more heat than punting to the Patriots, even though it's the better move. So I like that is kind of one thing that I learned from the Super Bowl and this whole conversation and the conversation with like the Panthers front office and the Browns front office, who are being like super vehemently anti-analytics. They're much more interested in doing the thing that if it fails, it doesn't look as bad versus the thing that if it fails, it is not as bad, like truly.
Well, and the incentive structure for them is just simply different, right? That you're already a head coach in the NFL. I can't remember who the quote was by. I listened to this on the Bet the Process podcast with Rufus Peabody. And it was like, it was sort of, you know, you're going to get further in life being wrong with the crowd than being wrong on a limb every, you know? And so it's this whole thing like, well, I make a poor decision over and over and over again, but so does everybody else. So I'm no worse than the people I'm competing against. And that's, you know, that's why it takes guts, I think. And that's why, you know, what the Eagles sort of consistently did should not be scoffed at over time.
So another thing I wanted to ask you guys about a little bit, you know, before we kind of get into some of the other things we wanted to talk about today. So the Eagles as a team seem to defy some of the, I guess, the league-wide trends we see in terms of kind of which positions are important and which positions you need to be good at to be a great team. Like one of the things that I know that we talked about very briefly, but we talked about, you know, the points don't correlate as strongly with, you know, your defensive line. You want to have, you know, great corners, et cetera, et cetera. Eagles don't really have great corners. I mean, they have solid safety play. I guess, like, help me understand, you know, why that team was as good as it was. And when you look at the pass catch, like, you know, Alshon Jeffrey is Alshon Jeffrey, but he didn't have a great season. I mean, they have Kelsey, who's Kelsey was a great center. They have a great line. But again, like, the positions that you think of them being elite at aren't the positions that you generally think of being, you know, the ones that get you the most points. I guess help me understand how the Eagles were able to do what they were able to do with the team built the way the team was built.
I would say just variance, right? So, I mean, Patrick Robinson was one of the best rated corners in the league, and we certainly as Vikings fans saw his effects. But you're right, Ronald Darby, Jalen Mills are not, you know, anything to write home about. And, you know, they have that pass rush, but as we said, that's a little less correlated with winning than you know, we'd like to think about. But ultimately, right, Carson Wentz played an outlier type season for 13 games. They won, what, 12 of them, maybe 11 of them. And then, you know, during the course of the playoffs, they probably should have lost a game to the Atlanta Falcons, who I think are constructed in a way that's probably more conducive to winning statistically over time. But then they won that game. And then the last two games of the season, Nick Foles graded out as one of the more like the best passers in the history of PFF's rankings for like two straight games, right? So I think like you can attribute it to like the guys, you know, the players that make the needle move the most played in such a way at the right times for the Eagles, and that's partially math and partially I think just variance.
All right, Luke, you have any additional takes about the Super Bowl, people using analytics? Do you have a hot take about whether this is the end of the Patriots dynasty? Anything else you want to throw in there before we move on to talk about the really, really rousing details, the things that people really, really want us to get into on this podcast?
I do think that just off your last question, the whole like they won in the trenches thing, and we've talked a lot about how like no, pass catchers and like cornerbacks and secondary members are more valuable than the big guys usually. I think that is a trend that when you go over like a whole league-wide sample bears out, but when you go from like team to team, like both the Vikings and the Patriots had a lot of trouble dealing with the pressure that that the Eagles were able to generate, and they had a lot of trouble generating pressure in a way that like definitely change the outcome of those games. So I know that like a lot of times listeners want to like take things in a binary way. This is just like a general quality of human stat consumption. But, you know, when we say, hey, you know, a cornerback is more valuable than an edge defender, that does not mean that an edge defender is not inherently valuable. They can still definitely change the course of a game. And I mean, we see that all the time. And we did see that with the Eagles, you know, if they were as good on offense and defensive line, like if they were as good in the secondary as they were on defensive line, then we might also see them win the same number of games, or maybe even, you know, go 14-2 and win the Super Bowl convincingly, or be even better. There's, you know, a lot of different ways to skin a cat.
Okay. All right. I will take that. And I misspoke before we get to the truly special part of the show. Eric put out a call for some questions. And we did get a question, and it's a question. It's a good question because there's multi parts to this question. I think we need to get, you know, to that question there and make sure that we don't forget to respond to that one there. So Eric, I guess did you want to read the tweet before we get
right
into it?
So wow, okay. So Brandon at Pissed Off Viking, is there any hope for Laquon Treadwell? Might he pull a Trey Waynes and figure it out? So this is an interesting question because obviously both guys are first-round picks. Both guys, in the eyes of Vikings fans, are very underwhelming in year one and two. I will say though, if I were Trey Waynes, I'd be fairly offended that I was put in the same question, in the same like sentences as Laquon Treadwell, because Trey Waynes played like, you know what, 800 to 1,000 snaps his first 2 years, had some interceptions, certainly was not great, but was a contributor to the team, whereas, as we're going to go through, I think, in a second here, Laquon Treadwell has not really contributed much of anything so far.
Yeah.
I don't see like a resurgence coming. Like, I think it would have had to look a lot different, right? You would have had to see some flashes of ability. I mean, you had like one really cool catch in the Packers game that was like very clearly an outlier. Whereas like Trey Waynes in his second year, you like saw some plays, you saw some flashes and just kind of like a general slow burn. You saw him trending upward where Treadwell is pretty stagnant. And if he were to turn it around, you'd probably have to get out of the shadow of Diggs and Thielen somehow, which would mean either one of them got injured or there was some crazy trade going on or something stupid.
Or Jarius Wright, his ample shadow as well.
Yeah. He still can't get out of the shadow of Jarius Wright. I think about like Nelson Agholor who had the kind of career trajectory that we would hope Treadwell has, but like there was a position switch in there and they started using him differently. I think the Vikings are using Treadwell in the way that he should be used. You know, they're not having him run like dumb routes or anything. They're having him run genuine pass patterns, but he just isn't getting thrown at. I guess the only hope there is hey, the narrative that, hey, he's getting a lot of separation, but he's just not getting targeted because, you know, Adam Thielen was the first read on every play or whatever, which I guess there's some credence to, but you would hope that that would manifest itself in a little bit more of a tangible way in the first 2 years of his career.
So I just, sorry guys, I was knocked off my game there. I had a moment. I forgot that PFF was like putting like all the stuff back into the like the signature stats.
Yeah.
And so I went, you know, digging to go look for some stats, and then like the screen popped up and I was like, whoa. And so like I kind of lost myself in the screen because it took me back a couple years when like we all had access to this stuff and you guys were talking and saying stuff, and I was just kind of fixated on like the old like plus minus grades that like used to be up there. And so I'm sure you guys made a lot of really, really great points. But yeah.
So you were mesmerized by the PFF data. You went in and found out that Jarius Wright, Vikings quarterbacks had a 131 passer rating throwing to Jarius Wright, and a Spurgeon win like 52.6 passer rating with throwing to Laquon Treadwell. Or you know, like if you're so there's like yards per route runs and another thing, like Julio Jones is like a 3.08, like a pretty good student in college. If you look at Laquon Treadwell yards per route run, talking about 0.67, so he basically got a D and a bunch of Fs in his first semester. He's probably going to have to get kicked out of school, right?
I mean, like,
what do you guys think? Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, I just, you know, like he's played. I know that they mentioned that, you know, he had the injuries rookie years, but like, you know, one of the things we were joking about before we went on and started recording, like, he's played in 20 more games than Kevin White and only has 22 more yards than Kevin White on his career. Like, Kevin White's played 5 NFL games. And I don't think
to be fair, the Bears quarterbacks have been way better than the Vikings quarterbacks. Oh. So you got to control for like how good Mike Glennon is. So like,
yeah, I just don't see. I don't see. But there was another part to this question, you know, like because you know we're going kind of hard on Treadwell, but is Trey Waynes like, is he truly turned the corner? Because I still wouldn't be upset if they drafted a corner in like the first 3 rounds.
I don't think he's turned the corner to the degree that you don't draft a cornerback who can help you. Like, if you're going to go into the 2018 season with Alexander, Waynes, and Rhodes as your 3 top corners, that's not going to cut it, in my opinion, because it didn't cut it in 2017 either, right? They went out and got Tremaine Brock. They expanded Newman's role. So I think Waynes is a part of that equation. Now, he had a pretty good season. I think he's always going to be a guy who gets beat a fair amount, but he does tackle well. He does make plays on the ball at times. I think like he's a player that's going to, I'll be very interested to see whether or not he gets the 5th-year option, for example, but I don't think he's been anywhere near the disaster that I think, you know, some people think he is, but at the same time, it would have been nice to have Marcus Peters.
Yeah, he blossomed into like an above average CB2.
Yeah. But Marcus Peters might be on the trade block. You know,
if the Chiefs trade Marcus Peters, if the Chiefs trade Marcus Peters, I'll be pretty upset because like Vikings fans too. Obviously Marcus Peters is nowhere near as talented as Randy Moss, but Randy Moss, like people always like say, well, he takes plays off, all this kind of nonsense. Like Randy Moss was a tension to be managed. And then eventually, like for some stupid reason, Mike Tice thought he became a problem. Right, there's a difference between problems and tensions to be managed. Marcus Peters is totally a tension to be managed. He's not perfect. He's a great player though, and like those kind of like cornerbacks are in Moss's case is like game changing wide receivers. Like you can't just like trade a guy and be like, oh yeah, we got Napoleon Harris and Troy Williamson back. You know, it's like if the Chiefs trade Marcus Peters, like I can guarantee you that they're not going to get somebody, you know, nearly as good as him in return. So I don't know why they would do that other than the fact they think he's a problem when in reality you get paid the big bucks as coaches to take, you know, to manage players that are a little bit, you know, difficult, right? That's your job. So do it, you know, because put a team of choir boys together, they're going to suck.
Brad Childress.
Yeah. And Eric, can we steal another thing from that other podcast that you do that's very good that if everyone who listens to this podcast has yet to subscribe to the Pro Football Focus Forecast, you should do that because it is a very good pod. Eric and George do great work. But I did want Eric to touch on one more thing here because one of the things that gets thrown around a lot probably shouldn't be, but it's thrown around a lot, is passer rating against. And so what we've seen or what we hear is that Trey Waynes is way better because his passer rating against was, you know, better than league average. Same thing with our man Mackenzie Alexander. I saw that. I think it was actually a PFF graphic that threw that up the other day, telling me how good.
I'm working on that.
Telling me how good our man Mackenzie Alexander was because of his, you know, passer rating against. Can you help me understand or help the listeners understand why passer rating against is probably not the best statistic for us to use when evaluating the play of cornerbacks?
So in general, the closer you are to the conclusion of a play, the more valuable what you do is on a expected points level. So like a plus 0.5 pass rushing grade is not worth as much as a plus 0.5 coverage grade, simply because you can beat a guy at the line of scrimmage, put pressure on the quarterback, and the quarterback's got brass balls and he completes a 15-yard rope, you know, to a wide receiver, and all your work didn't matter, right? But if you're on the back end of a defensive play and you earn a plus 0.5 defensive grade, unless you like somehow knock the ball away and it gets tipped up and caught, like that play, you basically ended it for the offense, right? So that's the part of the dichotomy is the fact that like we see it's a very explanatory variable. When a team has a bunch of guys who have really low passer ratings against, generally speaking, they've been a good defense that year. However, the closer you are to the conclusion of the play, the less stable what you do is as well. So we find that like pass rushing grades, run defense grades, their correlation coefficients are far above 0.5, 0.6, something like that. If you think about R squared, you're talking about 0.25, 0.3. If you're looking at that for defensive backs in like coverage, so yards per route run against or you know, passer rating against, it's like 0.2, 0.25. So you know, square that, you're talking about, you know, 0.1 or something like that. And so like super unstable, right? So, you know, I'm looking here at like, and so this is like kind of a cool thing if you're thinking about like who to fade next year, right? Like you look and say, okay, AJ Boye of Jacksonville, William Jackson from Cincinnati, he is not going to give up a 36 passer rating into coverage next year, right? That's simply not going to happen. And part of the reason that, or AJ Boye, you know, he gave up 0 touchdowns, 6 interceptions. And then we look in the playoff game against Pittsburgh and he gives up at least 1, I think maybe even 2 touchdowns. And that gets to like sort of the second point about pass rating against, which is like pass rating is just a really silly statistic in the sense that interceptions and touchdowns, which are relatively fluky, change the game so much that, you know, Nick Foles' passer rating when throwing deep against New England was 100. It would have been 140 if Alshon Jeffrey would have hauled in that deep pass. Instead, it was intercepted by Daron Harmon. You see what I'm saying? So even the number in and of itself isn't particularly stable to small perturbations in what happens. So yeah, as you said, like when we talk about this kind of stuff privately, and I'm more than willing to sort of like be a little bit critical of when people post stuff that I don't think is informing the public very well. But like pass rating against is one of those things I would say, hey, oh, that's why he was good this year. I wouldn't use it to say, oh, he's going to be a stud for the rest of time.
And so I guess when you look at pass rating against, is that one of those things that I guess when we look at them and we're seeing those type of things, we should just kind of take them in as descriptive, and they just told us kind of what happened versus, you know, that means that player is amazing or that player is bad and that's how he's going to be forever. Would that be an accurate or an accurate way of kind of taking that type of statistic versus some of the other stuff you guys put out?
Yeah, I would. I mean, there are extremes, right? So if David Amerson, so the Chiefs just signed David Amerson, he gave up a perfect pass rating into his coverage last year. So that's like, you know, I'd kind of drill down a little bit deeper. Is it because, you know, he gave up 4 touchdowns and didn't have an interception, or is it because literally guys are just completing every single ball on him? And it was kind of the latter there. So I'd be a little bit harsher on David Amerson, but I wouldn't be surprised if he did a little bit better. Desmond King for the Los Angeles Chargers graded really well for us, but he gave up 100 passer rating into his coverage because the passes that were completed on Desmond King, 78% of them were complete, but it was only at 9.2 per clip, and he didn't get interception luck, right? Still a fantastic player, but kind of a crappy statistic to measure him by, because, you know, completed passes, as we know with Sam Bradford in 2016, really do help your passer rating. And you kind of look, I'm trying to look like a little bit further down at players that might not be quite as good, but, you know, kind of down the list here, it might take me a little bit, but like, you know, there's like Trey Waynes is a good example. Mike Hilton for Pittsburgh gave up 70% of the passes into his coverage to be complete, but he got some interceptions. So his pass rating against a little bit lower than, you know, probably the, you know, what we would expect. And so, yeah, I would simply take these things with a grain of salt. The one year that our guy Xavier Rhodes gave up a passer rating that was lower than spiking the ball in every play, that's like a cool thing to say. But obviously this next season, I wouldn't say that he was any worse than the year before, but he gives up a 73 passer rating, right? Doubles it basically. So like how really, you know, stable or predictive is that measure over the long haul?
Okay. So what we've determined is Laquon Treadwell, probably not good. Trey Waynes, probably okay. Luke, that fair? Or am I still being too harsh on Trey Waynes?
No, that seems good. I mean, it would take a very surprising set of circumstances. Like, if we came back at this time next year and we said, oh my God, Treadwell had a bounce back year, we'd probably be looking into something that we totally didn't see coming as the cause. So right now, all of the signs point to the fact that Treadwell probably won't become any sort of world beater, probably won't get a fifth-year option, and he'll just kind of play out his rookie contract and be gone, and then that's that.
And play special teams or whatever that, you know. I would say that the only chance for him is if one of the top two guys gets hurt and he just gets a lot of volume, and maybe the Vikings aren't quite as good as last year, so they're not going to run the ball in the second and, you know, second half so much, and he gets a lot of like kind of relatively cheap yards and that kind of thing. I don't see him turning into a really good receiver in any stretch.
I will say that it looks like the folks over at playerprofiler.com, a site that I do quite enjoy. I like the stuff they put out. They seem like they nailed the comp on this one, because, you know, if you go and look up our man Laquon Treadwell, the best comparable player that they've chosen for him based on their analytics and the way they do things over there was our friend, I guess we'll say Eric's friend because of his team allegiances, Mr. Dwayne Bowe. Dwayne Bowe.
But Dwayne Bowe was good. Taste Dwayne Bowe, right? He was good. He had a 1,000-yard season with Tyler Palco playing quarterback.
Yeah, what happened?
I mean, he fell off a cliff, but I think it was just because the first thing that Andy Reid did was give him a big contract. And then he kind of like fell off. But he had a good playoff game against the Colts once, even with Alex. And then the other thing is Alex Smith has never done well with kind of like the big, like big bodied receivers. And so like even like Chris Conley, guys like that have played after Bowe have really not had any success, which if you're thinking about, if you're a Redskins fan, you kind of wonder like where's, you know, like Josh Doctson, is he going to succeed with Alex Smith? Good question. But I also think it was like just a kind of a mismatched like interaction between quarterback and receiver.
Yeah, that's fair. All right. Well, enough beating up on players on our own team. Laquon Treadwell is still not very good. I also don't want Miles driving to my house to fight me for talking about his man, Laquon Treadwell. So let's move off this subject, and we can get to really the stuff that the reason people, you know, tune in to listen to this podcast. It's the takes that you just can't get anywhere else. It's that special brand of a fire that only Luke can deliver to you. So Luke, you know, you did some work for the site where we can find, you know, the majority of your stuff over at, you know, Purple PTSD, writing about the riveting topic, the thing, you know, possibly the player, the position group that you should draft in every draft because it is so important.
Punters are people too.
They are people too. Luke, tell us about them. Tell us about the punters. Tell us what you did. Tell us what you found. And then, you know, Eric, as you know how to do somehow, some way, you're able to find, it doesn't even matter what we're doing, you're able to find some way to sprinkle in some of that PFF goodness and some math and your teaching skills on it and somehow make it something that people want to listen to. We're going to see how good you really are today because we are going to talk about the punters. Yeah. Luke, the floor is yours, sir. Make punters interesting.
Yeah, so this is an exercise that I've been doing for 3 years now. This is the third year of doing it. And I'm still kind of figuring it out in terms of like how to make the best formula with the data I have available to me. But essentially, it's all one big way to like try to fix the idea of net yards, which I still see people talk about when they talk about punters, saying, oh, he's the best net yards in the league, or the best punt yards in the league, which are just like totally ridiculous statistics, because depending on where you are on the field, like your goal is going to be different, whether you're trying to like kick with precision and pin someone deep, or kick, just boom one down the field if, you know, you're punting from your own 20 or whatever. Like, those are going to be different kicks, and they should be measured differently. So essentially, just splitting the field at the own 40-yard line, which is it was the 35 the first year I did this, and then I actually got to speak with Chris Cluey on the Purple Journal podcast a year ago about this, and he said that the 40 is a better line to go through because, you know, if you're on your own, like, 39, you're still booting it. So splitting it at the 40, basically saying taking the average punt yards on those, because those can just kind of be measured on like how deep did you make the return or kick it, or did you make the return or take it, and then on the short field punts, measuring them by a percentage of the field that you covered, which is a way to kind of adjust against, like, if you're punting from your own 42-yard line because your coach is an idiot, and you kick it out of the back of the end zone, you only gain 22 yards of field position on that. That's like not a very valuable play, but by like net punt yards or total punt yards, they'll count that as like just 20 yards, or they'll count that as, 42 yards of a punt, like an actually pretty good kick, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. So doing it as an actual percentage of the field covered, now that kick is like a 52% kick or whatever it is, and that's pretty bad, pretty far below average, and it knocks your average down a lot. So just splitting the field like that, I've been doing that for 3 years, and ranking punters thusly. I think if I had access to hang time data or directional data, that would be a lot better, just because, you know, there's a lot of value, and the Vikings do this all the time. We know that for a fact from like Chris Cluey talking about it to like every outlet possible, and just the fact that the numbers line up with it. Like, Ryan Quigley ranked pretty low in this exercise, but PFF has him graded 7th, and I know that PFF uses more hang time data, and I also know that the Vikings force the most fair catches in the league, which does elicit an idea that he's just kicking it high and short and making sure that we've essentially removed the punt return from the game, which is a super valuable thing. So if I had hang time data, I'd be able to like finesse it a little better, or even update the like percentage of the field measure that I'm using right now to maybe be like a field position earned, and then maybe just adjusting for how much further back you are. But that is, in a nutshell, what it is. I mean, I'm happy to go into like the actual results of it and who ranked where, but I you can just go to the article and find that if you're curious about someone.
Oh no, you don't get off that easy, Luke. I mean,
Shane Leckler was the best punter in the league. Yeah. Maybe Marquette King. There's a take for you.
So you had to once played for the Raiders to be good.
Yes,
it's the
correct.
I mean, I like Marquette King a lot. He's a great personality, and he's a good punter. He can whale the ball pretty well.
Yeah, he's been in the top five just about every year I've done this, and he's really good at the precision punts too. He's just good.
So our guy Quigley ranks low, not necessarily in the, I mean, he doesn't really rank low in either one of these. It's just like the combination of the two. He's not like, so how are these weighted? Are these weighted?
I weighted a little toward the long punts because they're more common.
Okay.
Let me pull up the actual thing, because I believe he's like bottom 10 in both.
Okay, I'm just, I guess, looking anecdotally, I guess. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he is bottom 10. It does look bottom 10 in both. So he's there.
Yeah.
We have him 7th because he, like you said, he forces the most fair catches, which means in terms of like expected points, like, although they did have that weird like Bryce Callahan punt return in the last week of the season, so that skews the return yards, but like for the longest time, and I guess even still, they were giving up, if you take away that return, they gave up like the 5th or 6th fewest yards in run backs And then you had the most fair catches. You had the least amount of balls down, which means, again, he's just like hanging the ball up there to be caught. Field position was a thing, right? Like, they had, you know, we're not punting from very deep. We had that. So as if you guys go to Pro Football Focus, we had the Vikings ranked as the top special teams. And this is kind of using like a machine learning thing to like look at and weight what's the most important. And we found the Vikings, you know, mostly because of their like strength and like cover units. So guys like CJ Ham, Ben Gedeon, Kentrell Brothers, Anthony Harris, Jaron Kearse, Marcus Sherrills is actually pretty good. Eric Wilson, they all graded like top, you know, very highly as coverage men, both on kickoffs and punts. And actually one of the other things that's important is that the kickoff return game has like reduced in value so much since the new rule that even though they didn't have Cordarrelle Patterson back there, really nobody kind of has Cordarrelle Patterson back there anymore. And so that kind of was stunted. Marcus Sherrills is actually still one of the better returners in the league, even though he hasn't run one back in quite some time. He's, you know, fantastic there. So, the Quigley thing is interesting. I personally don't grade the punters, so I do know that Cluey gave us our formula a while back, but I also do know that we have hang time that might, you know, contextualize that a little bit better.
Yeah, and when Cluey came on the podcast last year to talk about this, he said that splitting the field was a part of the PFF formula, so I think it's a fairly similar methodology, but PFF just has access to so much more data than a civilian.
Yeah, and Sherrills had a 9.8 yard return on punts this year, which is pretty high if you don't have a long touchdown. A lot, you know, fairly a larger than 10 yard return in like, you know, 10 of 16 games. So, you know, flipping the field a little bit there. But yeah, it's interesting. Good work on that. I mean, special teams matter, right? Like one of the things that's in our spread picks prediction algorithm in PFF, and we'll talk about this on the forecast too, is the kicking game. We have like field goals and extra points because it's you know, teams with good kickers generally are good teams, like, and teams that like slough off at the kicker position generally, you know, are weaker, I guess, like in just like decision making and that kind of thing. So it actually is a statistically significant variable when trying to predict games against the spread, which is really interesting.
That kind of makes sense too, because like if you're a bad roster, you're going to fix other things before you fix kicker.
Well, like the Chargers are a really good roster, but like chargering it up is to totally not have a kicker, right? And then they lose games. Like you know what I'm saying? Or like Tampa Bay has a good roster to some degree, but like when you're just like somewhat incompetent, you just end up like, you know, you end up struggling because, you know, you can't figure out the small little edges. And of course, picking games against the spread, like any little point matters, right? So it's important to sort of get those understood.
I think the Chargers are taking Robbie Aguayo into camp.
Yeah, I mean, why? How many? It's the Seattle Seahawks thing too. It's like and I like the Seahawks a lot. I think they're a really well-run organization, but like, there's a ton of guys who are not quite as talented as Blair Walsh who have the mental makeup to be a good kicker, and they should get a chance over Blair Walsh. The chance that Blair Walsh's 56-yard field goal is going to matter more than the five he's going to miss because he's a basket case are really low. You know what I'm saying? So I would take the mental makeup person, the guy with the mental makeup, over the guy with the quote-unquote leg talent like Aguayo or Walsh.
The Seahawks seem to be one of those teams, and I don't know, Eric, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like they're one of those teams that to a degree buy into like some things that are, you know, analytically driven, but it's like they have someone like me who doesn't actually know enough about the math making the decisions, like where they look at the spreadsheet like I looked at it, and it's like, oh, offensive line isn't important, so let's get them all out of here right away. They all can go. Trade away all of our offensive linemen because offensive line doesn't matter. Whereas I feel like if they had, you know, some people maybe with, you know, a bit more a bit better of an understanding of how the math actually works and what all these things actually mean, maybe they'd make some more nuanced decisions. But it feels like there was a point along the way there where they just kind of said, huh, we're going to do this thing. And it was probably based on something that wasn't old school coaches football. It probably was based on something where someone just was like, hey, guys, look at what the spreadsheet told me. Let's do that without really understanding what they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Seahawks are cursed by their own success. So you have Russell Wilson, who's fantastic. You end up having to pay him. You have Doug Baldwin, who was an undrafted free agent. Now you have to pay him. KJ Wright, Bobby Wagner, Richard Sherman, Cam Chancellor, you know, Earl Thomas, Michael Bennett, Cliff. Like, you have all these players that are good, and they're all, like, integral parts of the team. And to some degree, they haven't done some of the belly checking and things, which is to get rid of a few of them. And what they've done is said, you know, and Tom Cable's, I think, a sharp guy in some degree. Like, I think he's a forward thinker. But, like, their bet that, like, well, we can pay Tom Cable this much money and he can coach up our offensive line to get to just average. Because what we've talked about is, like, the difference between an average and a TJ Clemmings offensive line is so much more than a TJ the average offensive line and a line full of Tyron Smiths. So I get the logic and I understand it, but it's a bet, right? And sometimes bets don't work out. And I think to some degree, although they were 9-7, right? So it's hard to like argue, you know, that it's hard to argue, right? To they make a couple plays here and there against like the Jaguars or the Falcons, and they're in the playoffs with one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL yet again. So I don't know. It's weird. I'm conflicted about it.
I think they've made, like, in general, I don't think that strategy has doomed them on its own. But they've done some other, like, baffling, just poor decisions that don't necessarily constitute, like, we put less resources in. But, like, they took Ethan Posick in the second and moved him to tackle, like, when he was a center and he was supposed to be, like, one of the better interior linemen in the draft. And, like,
Jermaine Ifedi pick was rough, too.
Yeah, the Jermaine Ifedi pick was just a miss. That's just spending a lot on a bad player. But...
yeah.
Like they took, like, you can try to build your offensive line out of undrafted free agents. You don't necessarily have to try to build your offensive line out of, like, guys who used to be basketball players and, like, guys, like, transitioning people from defensive line to offense. Like, you don't need to make it that much harder on the unit. Like, if you want to say, okay, I'm going to go discount offensive line and not care about it and hope that my coach can, you know, coach up a bunch of discount players and make them good, that's fine. But, like, they made it so much harder on themselves by, like, further doubling down on trying to do crazy, weird crap, like trying to find all these diamonds in the rough. And it just doesn't really, it made a lot of sense that they were bad, not because they didn't spend on it, but because they just did so many convoluted things.
Right.
I think the part of the memo they didn't get to is that tackles are still kind of important.
Like, yeah.
If you want to mess around on the interior, you can probably try to coach around that, but, like, you need someone to play tackle. Like, at least one of your tackles, probably both of them, has to be at least okay.
Yep. We found that statistically. We're writing up a few, like, research articles for teams going into the combine, and it's like, you have to, like, a bad play by a tackle is worth quite a bit of points, actually. And not as much as a bad play by a quarterback or whatever, but, like, it's rough. So, you do have to, like, I do agree with you. Sloughing off on the interior of the line is probably the way to go first if you're going to, and then tackle. And then they found that out. Like, I think their offense is a little bit more successful once they got Dwayne Brown in the mix. But, you know, they had to spend resources to get him, which that's always the issue, right?
So what is that? What do you guys think about all of this hype about the Vikings, like, definitely taking a guard in the first round then? Because I feel like there's a lot of guys that I'm, like, I really like Billy Price. I think he'd be a really fun guy to pair next to Elfline, but we're also spending a first rounder on a guard when that's, like, the one place that maybe you could slough off.
I would like them to not do that.
Yeah. I would say, I mean, so there's this degree, like, of, you know, you're getting the best player at this position because everybody undervalues him. I think that there's a point at which that happens, but I would say it's probably middle, second round. So if they have to move back to do that, that's probably okay. But I mean, and it's also hard to, like, figure out, like, what the Vikings need, but I would say, like, I would probably go for a tackle, a three technique, you know, trying to think of probably another defensive back, to be honest with you. And a coverage linebacker that could possibly take over for Barr. I would probably look at those positions before, you know, backup defensive end, right? I would look at those positions before guard.
Yep, yeah, Eric, I like, pretty much nailed my thoughts on it as well.
Yeah, there's some guys that are going to probably fall too. I see a lot of mock drafts that have us taking like Ronnie Harrison, or I see Maurice Hurst falling sometimes, which would be very exciting because he's like a Sharif Floyd clone.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the other part of that is that, you know, yeah, like if you pick a guard or a center even early, I mean, that guy's probably going to be really, really good. But when you look at, you know, historical draft data anyway, like the positions, like when you get into the mid rounds, the, you know, those interior linemen are the positions, I mean, using approximate value as kind of your measure of player quality, which isn't perfect, isn't ideal, but those are the position groups that tend to be the most valuable when you get into that kind of the mid rounds there, rounds 3 through 5. So that's kind of the reason that I would want to wait. I mean, look, we got Pat Elflein, who was, you know, not as strong on PFF scoring, but you could tell there was a big difference when he was on the field, not on the field for the Vikings. And, you know, he was a third round pick, kind of showing that, you know, there is value to be mined at those interior spots in the middle of the draft.
Right. And Brandon Scherff is a, what, top 10 pick. And he's, I mean, I would, you would have to go a long way to convince me that he's worth more than he's worth. The difference between a first and a sixth round pick between like Brandon Fusco, for example, like Fusco didn't, he flamed out, but he had a couple years where he was just as good as Brandon Scherff. And, you know, the Vikings got him with a pretty, you know, low end pick, and the, you know, Washington had to draft him high. So, you know, those kinds of things, I would say you just have to make the value judgment. And with guard, I just don't think they move the needle enough to really make, a top pick sort of worth it.
I feel like you have to kind of take, sorry, one last thing.
Do it.
You have to kind of take, like, if you're going to take an interior lineman in the top rounds, I feel like one way to maybe make it more valuable is to take one of those guys, and there's, you know, usually a handful of them every year that, like, played tackle in college, but because of their measurable and stuff, like, project better to guard, but can still be, like, a backup swing tackle if your guy goes down. Just ways to, like, add a little bit of extra value to your picks so that you can kind of like kill two birds with one stone. And now maybe you have whoever playing at guard, but then they can maybe be a little bit better than like Jeremiah Searles or Rashad Hill if one of your tackles goes down, and like help you mitigate and like have extra insurance there, just to add a little bit of versatility to the guys instead of just, you know, drafting a guy that like is just only going to ever contribute so much to your offense just by virtue of the position he plays.
I guess, Eric, tell me about Zach Fulton. Because for me, I'm of the mind, and I at some point will probably have time, and for my own, at least for my own mind, we'll go and do some digging on this. But I feel anyway, like for positions like, you know, the interior line on both sides of the ball, so, you know, defensive tackle and, you know, the interior offensive lineman, it always seems as though if you're a savvy GM, and Spielman has shown himself to be that, you know, with the signing of Linville Joseph and others, that you can find value at those interior lineman positions in free agency. Zach Fulton's a name that gets kicked around a lot. A, is he good? And I know you know this because, you know, you follow the team he used to play for. Is he good? And, you know, he's not really expected to command a lot of money. Like, would it be better to make a move to kind of fortify things with a value signing on a guy like that, and then free up your premium draft resources for some of like the big money positions, like, you know, edge rusher, corner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, we as Vikings fans have seen this, right? Joe Berger was a guy that the Vikings picked up for barely nothing, and he's put together a lot of good seasons. Corbin Lacina way back in the day, think about that, all the way back, was a kind of a swing guy. So Zach Fulton's been a guy that I sort of inexplicably, in my opinion, the Chiefs have never like committed to, but he's played a ton of snaps because, you know, they've always sort of had injuries, and he's done a pretty good job. I'm looking at his grade this last season. He was very good in pass protection, was not quite as good in run blocking. But he played 790 snaps. Well, you had playoffs, about 850. He played about 850 2016. Most of his 2017 snaps were at center. Most of his snaps in 2016 were at guard. And he's steadily improved every single year, especially as a pass blocker. His grade has increased steadily. He gave up no sacks last year, only one quarterback hit. Center is a little bit easier not to give up pressure there, but still, I think that's a good sign. I think his position flexibility, his ability to go and play all three interior positions is fantastic. And as you said, for some reason, he's not going to command a lot of money. So I think he'd be a great, great player for the Vikings to go after and to sort of pay a premium for. But I mean, I think what we found later in the season is you're going to have injuries on the interior offensive line, and it's good to invest in those spots.
All right. So we have the Eric seal of approval on our man, Mr. Fulton. I like it. Rick Spielman, we know you're listening. Make that happen. And I feel like we've covered all the topics plus a couple of extra ones. I guess, Luke, did you have anything else you wanted to touch on? Any other? Normally, this would be the point where I asked Eric for like help with my fantasy football team or like my picks for the weekend, but there's no football and I'm sad.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure how to end the show now. Like, Luke, how do we transition to the end?
I don't know what I'm going to write about. Probably something with quarterbacks. So look out for that whenever that drops. But I'm kind of slowing down the pace. I'm not going to be posting weekly now until stuff starts happening again.
Well, this off-season stuff is really killing us here. But I guess, I think it might be halftime now. So, Eric, we won't keep you away from watching how your money's doing for the second half.
Well, hey, at least I have a problem, but at least I'm honest about it. I have to go watch the second half now. The team Steph, the team that I was rooting for absolutely no reason, was up for a while and then has surrendered a lead. So I'll have the leading by two now. So yeah, I'll have to go and watch while I grade some papers.
That sounds like good times. Well, gentlemen, as always, thank you for coming on recording with me this evening. I'm going to go get a little bit deeper into these beers because it's a long weekend up here in Ontario.
Ah, good for you.
Family. It's family day, buddy. Canada, well, I won't say all of Canada because it's not family day everywhere. Ontario is about families. Also, Ontario is about making sure we have at least one holiday in every month. So they made this one up. Family day.
That's awesome.
Spend time
good for you guys. Just another reason to covet Canada just a little bit more.
Yeah, but it's cold up here, man. But I guess for you, it's cold up there too. Yeah. Yep. Come on up, Eric. You're almost Canadian now.
That's right. Can I be honorary at least?
I mean, yeah, we could do that. You have a Luke, down there basking in the weather and all of those other wonderful things that happen out there in California.
Yeah, I opened my windows today and I enjoyed it. I took a stroll this afternoon. It was fantastic.
Yeah, we hate you. We hate you. You're not a nice person. But gentlemen, as I said, good times. We will be back soon. We need to get in another recording before I go to Vegas because I need Eric to tell me all the things I need to know so I can make money on stupid bets before next football season. Kind of random awesome futures. So we will be in touch with y'all soon. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.